You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Salutations, salutorians, saliently salivating for salsa, salmon berries, and Salvador Dali. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show's episode 218. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your happy, snappy, strappy, yappy chappies.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
And let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz, Hotshot. Here, I have our random trivial pursuit card. You guys have your barnyard buzzers. Let's answer some questions. Here we go. Blue Edge for geography. Which actor was effectively banned from China after portraying Heinrich Herrer in the 1997 movie 7 Years in Tibet? That was the horse. Colin.
I think that was Richard Gere. Is that right?
Incorrect. Dana.
Was it Brad Pitt?
Correct. It is Brad Pitt. From the movie 7 Years in Tibet. The card here says he was allowed to visit with Angelina Jolie in 2014 while she promoted one of her films. So as an accessory to somebody, it's
right.
It's okay.
Banned, except for when he isn't. Yeah.
That invitation's closed now, I would guess.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Pink Wedge for pop culture. Contestants on which long-running TV competition have one goal: to outwit, outplay, and outlast one another.
I cannot take this from Chris.
Oh gosh.
I know. Chris, please.
I've watched this show. It's Survivor.
How many seasons are we in?
I think 40.
Just a ballpark number. 40?
40-ish. Yeah, well, they do two a year. Yeah. So it's been on for over 20 years. So they've done 40 seasons. Yeah. Yeah, not 40 years.
It's been on my whole life?
Yeah.
Fun fact, my father-in-law's realtor was one of the contestants in the first season of Survivor.
Oh.
First season. I remember the first season.
Who was
Jenna.
It? Jenna?
Jenna.
I remember first season people.
Everybody remember first season people. They all became like celebrities.
Yeah. And or went to jail, right?
Yeah.
A different kind of celebrity, I guess.
Those are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Yellow Wedge. Which English monarch was on the throne at the time of the American Civil War? Colin. Yeah.
Queen Victoria, right?
Correct. Victoria.
Oh, okay.
Woo, I was panicking there for a minute. I was like, I was just talking about this. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Funny enough, that was actually a question on our Good Job Brain monthly quiz packet for our Patreon pledgers.
I knew it sounded so familiar, so your packet is already paying off with helping with trivia. I knew the answer to this.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so on Patreon, we have a tier. It's $10 or more. You get like a monthly quiz pack that you can print at home and run pub trivia Good Job Brain style with your family, your friends, yourself, your dogs, cats, your lizards.
And if your dog gets a question right, please write in and tell us.
Queen Victoria.
Uncanny.
Oh my god, a talking dog.
Purple Wedge, weird one. What topped Lake Superior State University's 2016 list of banished words? Multiple choice.
Okay.
Okay.
2016.
Lake Superior State University list of banished words. Okay.
Okay.
Word number one, so, like S-O.
Okay. Okay.
Word number two, man spreading. Word number three, vape.
Gosh.
Banned.
Wow.
Word.
Banned. Banished words. Well, the weird one here is so.
So.
Yeah.
So I'll just guess. I mean, I'm not going to buzz in or anything, but I'm going to say I think that. Does anybody else want to just, we all want to just guess here and see what happens?
I'll support that half-hearted effort. I agree with you. It's conspicuous.
Why is it on there? Yeah.
It's conspicuous compared to the others. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would be a weird distractor. Let me put it that way. If that wasn't the answer.
So that was kind of like a window through our pub trivia team, how we talk it out. You are correct, Chris. It is so.
Okay.
Because that seems a little bit out of left field. And the reason is, it's because, the card says, it's because so many people begin sentences with it.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Weird language policing kind of thing.
That's terrible.
So comes in more of a conversational type of language setting when we speak. I don't think anybody's writing, you know, typing out in papers, S-O.
Oh, I do. I actually do.
Really?
When I'm in, I kind of became conscious of it. I tend to write, especially in Slack. I tend to sort of consciously try to write how I speak, just because I'm trying to convey friendliness, because some people do not. But I often find myself looking back on a bunch of messages I've just written, and like every sentence starts with so. It's like, so I'm noticing that this is going on.
Yeah, I do
so
that
what
too.
I think we should do. So I'm just checking with you to make sure it's okay.
Yeah.
It's also a subtle way of just establishing that these are threaded. You know what I mean?
I just want to
kind of ease into that sentence, you know, just gently go into it.
There was at my junior high school, there was a teacher who, if you were answering a something class and you said like, you know, in the middle of, and he, like, the teacher would say, like, when you said it, they would just echo it right back at you. And that was it. And that was just their like annoying, subtle way, or not so subtle, I guess, of trying to correct you. And it went beyond comical to truly frustrating if you were trying to like actually say something. I just did it myself, of course, there.
Yeah.
If you have a speech impediment or you're nervous, guess what? You're going to get slapped down and publicly humiliated by the professor. Yep. Enjoy your speaking in front of the class. Great.
Ever again. Anyways, so let's move on to the Green Wedge.
That's fine.
Green Wedge for Science and Nature. What is the term for a natural depression in a land surface formed by the dissolution and collapse of a cavern roof? I'll say it again. Mm-hmm. What is the term for a natural depression in a land surface formed by the dissolution and collapse of a cavern roof? Chris.
How about a sinkhole?
It is a sinkhole.
Yeah. All right.
Last question on this card. Which of the following is not a yoga pose? Multiple choice.
Okay.
Kite, torch, plow, or chair?
All right. I'll tell you right now,
it's not chair. That's my least favorite position.
Yeah, I know chair is one.
Kite, plow, or torch is basically what we're looking
at. Is there anything we can eliminate right off the bat? Like you do yoga and you've done this pose. I mean, chair is one.
Yeah. I thought it was all dogs.
I should know this. I think torch is one.
Yeah, like holding your hand like Statue of Liberty.
I would say no kite. Because I think plow, they are plows in India, where yoga's from. But kites, I don't think of as Indian. I know there are kites in India, but...
I like the reasoning.
Let's flip the card. It is torch!
Oh, really? Okay.
I wanted to have little pictures of the poses on there.
I know!
Probably beyond the scope of the card.
Because torch seems like it would maybe be part of the warrior sequences.
Well, you know what? It's a good question. It's a well-written question, because the wrong answer was such a suckery answer.
Yep. And we have our listener extra bonus fun fact / question. This is from our purple Patreon pledge, Steve Gill from Louisville, Kentucky.
Covering all the bases.
So here's his question for you guys today. He says, Pluto used to be the smallest planet in the solar system until it was downgraded to a dwarf planet. So we already know every planet is larger than Pluto, but can you guess how many moons in the solar system are larger than Pluto?
Oh.
Multiple choice.
Okay.
Oof. Okay. Thank
Two,
God.
Three, five, or seven.
Two, three.
How many moons are larger than Pluto? in our I'm gonna go on the high side. I'm gonna go on the high side. I'm gonna say 5 or 7. Yeah, I mean, just because some of these planets have so many dang moons, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, and Pluto is really little. Yeah, sure, 7.
I'll say 5.
The correct answer is 7, and here are the 7: Ganymede, Titan, Callisto, Io, Europa, Triton, and everybody's favorite, our moon. The moon.
Good old moon.
The moon is bigger than Pluto. I don't think I realized that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me neither.
Wow.
Now that Pluto's not the smallest planet in our solar system, what planet is the smallest
now? Isn't it
Mercury?
Mercury's pretty small. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yes. An additional fun fact from Steve: Jupiter's Ganymede and Saturn's Titan both are larger than Mercury.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some big moons out there. Yeah.
Too many dang moons.
Too many dang moons on Disney Plus. That's when they start scraping the barrel for Star Wars properties to turn into TV shows. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Steve. And I want to give a very, very special shout out to McScribeface. McScribeface, which is the name of our Good Job Brain volunteer transcription squad. A bunch of people volunteered to start transcribing our catalog of 200 episodes. It's a small start, but, you know, awesome job. Thank you.
So kind.
Stu. Thank you, Amber. Thank you.
My mind's like, nothing I say is worth writing down. What are you doing? Yes, thank you.
Today's theme for the episode was inspired by a few things I want to share with you guys. Earlier this October, the winner of the 28th annual Golden Spurtle was announced. And what exactly is a Golden Spurtle? Well, what's even just a normal non-Golden Spurtle?
Isn't that a Pokemon?
That's what I thought. Pokemon. That's Squirtle, though, I think.
Yeah, that's my only guess.
This is the first time I've looked it up. A Spurtle is a cooking utensil hailing all the way from Scotland. It's kind of like... It's kind of like a hefty wooden wand. Like, okay. It's a rod. And, okay. And it's traditionally used to stir porridge. So instead of a spoon or a spatula, it's this like thick magician's wand.
Stick.
It's a very traditional tool. And as for the Golden Spurtle, well, it's also known as the annual World Porridge Making Championship.
Oh.
And it made the news earlier this October. Miriam Groot from the Netherlands took home the honor of having awarded the Golden Spurtle this year. And it was a little bit different this year because it had to be held virtually. And so people submitted their recipe. And,
yeah.
No, she just takes a bite over Zoom. She's like, this is the best porridge I've ever had.
Seems like a challenge for a cooking contest. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say.
Just doing it through Zoom. They're just like, that's good.
Ooh, that one looks like, really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you hold it up to the camera a little closer? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pre-pandemic times, the World Porridge Making Championship is held in Carbridge, Scotland. So two main categories. One category is OG regular porridge making. And then there's another category, which is like specialty porridge, where they can add things or make it into a different form. And so for this virtual version, they just did the specialty thing. They had to submit like a recipe, and then they submit a video of them cooking it. So this year, Miriam Groot won. She made, get this, arancini out of porridge oats. So arancinis are Italian, the deep fried risotto balls.
Oh.
But she made it with, you know, risotto oats.
Nice.
And then also Halloween just happened. We also talked a bit about candy recently on the show too. So I think it's time for something salty. So this week, are you worth your salt?
So, Karen, I have to ask, can you go back to your alliteration and read us some of the words that you used in your alliteration?
I said salutations, salutorians, saliently salivating for salsa, salmon berries, and Salvador Dali.
So at least a couple of those words come from the word salt.
Yeah.
Definitely, I think salivating. Definitely salsa.
Salsa, sure. Yeah.
What? Salsa comes from, sauce. The word sauce comes from salt. It all comes from the Latin, you know, sal or salt. Salad.
Oh, it goes back to salt. Yeah.
Salad comes from salt because the first salads were mixed vegetables and they put a salty brine or the dressing over them, the ancient Romans. So that's where salad comes from, was from the word salt. And even sauce, like sauce is a salty thing you put on.
I had no idea.
Celery comes from salt also.
Whoa.
You know, probably not because people, I think people said like, oh, because they, you know, salt was so valuable that the you know, the Roman soldiers were paid in salt. I think it actually might just mean, like other people have said, it might just mean like it's your salt money. You know, it's your money to go buy salt and other things. Salt is just so fundamental. It's so important to sustaining human life, right? Like we think of it now as like an optional condiment that we add on to things. Just, you know, a couple hundred years ago, like then past that, the beginning of humanity, people have always had to be thinking like, where are we going to get salt? Very important. I'd heard that it becomes more important to get salt, to get like rock salt when you start living in cities. And because with hunter gatherers, they would go kill a fresh animal and just like eat it raw and they'd get all the sodium that they might need from that. But then when people started living in cities and towns and things like that, it started to be like, well, we need salt and we need salt, put it on our bodies. But then also we need huge quantities of it, certainly in like Britain and the American colonies, to preserve our meat with, because nobody refrigerator. Now, there were salt mines. There's salt mines in Great Britain where they were getting a lot of salt, like rock salt that was like under the earth. And when they first started sending the first, you know, colonists like to, you know, modern day America, they were kind of hoping that like maybe they'll find some salt, you know, maybe they'll sort of, maybe there'll be a bunch of salt over there and they can start adding to the British Empire's
commodities,
strategic salt reserves.
Yeah, exactly. Because like if you're an individual, you're wondering, where am I as an individual going to get salt? And if you're a government or, you know, a world power, you're wondering on a macro scale about salt supplies. I found this story that I'm titling Thomas Jefferson's Salt Mountain. because this was fascinating. So the colonists get to America and they realize, you know, they're set up shop on the East Coast. There's no salt. They're not finding vast natural quantities of salt. So they end up importing their salt from Great Britain.
Really?
So Britain, yes. So America imported a lot of its salt. And they also found that Native Americans did not actually generally use salt to preserve their meats. They smoked them. So their traditional method of preserving meats was smoking over a low fire. Then, like around 1776 or so, becomes kind of difficult for the colonies, which are now in open rebellion, to import salt from Great Britain. This is when you see a lot of salt works opening up on the coastal states. Essentially,
is that just like drying?
Exactly, drying it out of the seawater. This became a popular military target for the British Navy. They would go and find the salt works and try to destroy them. Salt was tough, you know, for the colonies during the Revolutionary War. It was tough to get your hands on. And so once the war was over, America starts up importing salt from Great Britain again. But still, it's like, how can we be salt independent? Where are we going to get some salt? So enter Thomas Jefferson, who you've no doubt heard about from the smash hit musical Hamilton, played to perfection on Broadway by DVD. Indeed. Was in fact a real person and was serving as the third president of the United States. How about that? 1801 to 1809, Jefferson was in office. And Jefferson, as you may know, was super hot for Western expansion. He wanted to continue to move west across the North American continent and take that land for America. And famously, Jefferson, of course, wanted to and did the Louisiana Purchase. Yep. Buying from France the rights to the middle of the modern United States of America.
Just a huge, huge chunk of land.
A huge chunk of land and a huge chunk of land that France didn't even, they never even went there. Like it was like France had established New Orleans in what is like modern day Louisiana. And then they're literally just like, and all that stuff up there is ours too. We've never been there. And we don't know what's up there, but that's just ours. That's ours now. Okay. Jefferson, when he did the Louisiana Purchase, he was buying outright the lands that France had was actually occupying, and they were like, we'll leave. Oh. But then the rest of it was like, we are paying you to agree that we are going to go in there and try to take it. You know, you're not going to stop us. Meanwhile, there's people living in there that would have been very surprised to find out.
To learn that their land had been claimed not once, but twice now.
Some guy who's never been here just sold my land to somebody else who's never been there.
Oh, man.
The other funny thing with the Louisiana Purchase is that it was, at this point, it was kind of an open constitutional question as to whether the president of the United States could even just buy a bunch of land, could spend, you know, at the time, $15 million, whether the president could even just unilaterally do that. It's like, well, shouldn't Congress kind of get involved? Remember, America's very young, you know? It's like, should Congress be doing this? Can the president do that? Well, he did. Yeah. He went ahead and bought it. Congress did end up ratifying the treaty, but Jefferson had to convince Congress, or wanted to try to convince Congress, why that this deal that he signed was good and that they should ratify it. So in the summer of 1803, you know, France and the U.S. signed this treaty. And then after that, Jefferson goes to Congress with this big report of information that he had assembled, like all about Louisiana. And then Louisiana at this point literally referred to modern day Louisiana state, and then straight up just a big old chunk of the whole thing. And this was in the report. Here we go. One extraordinary fact relative to salt must not be omitted. There exists, about 1,000 miles up the Missouri, and not far from that river, a salt mountain! Exclamation point in original.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point. Italics and exclamation point. A salt mountain!
Wow.
This mountain is said to be 180 miles long and 45 in width, composed of solid rock salt, without any trees or even shrubs upon it. That's salt awesome. Springs are very numerous beneath the surface of this mountain, and they flow through the fissures and cavities of it. So this was in this report that Jefferson sent to Congress. I guess I have to explain how unbelievable this, like how fanciful and this sounded like cities paved with gold, like because
the
sheer value of it. Like a fairy tale. And this was picked up on by especially a lot of the newspapers that were opposed to Thomas Jefferson at this point. The New York Evening Post wrote an editorial about this and was like, "We think that it would have been no more than fair if the traveler who informed Mr. Jefferson of this territory of solid salt to have added that some leagues to the westward of it, there was an immense lake of molasses, and that between this lake and the mountain of salt, there was an extensive vale of hasty pudding stretching as far as the eye could reach and kept in a state of comfortable eatability by the warmth of the sun's rays."
It's like Candyland.
This
Pulitzer Prize for sarcasm.
Yes.
I was like, is this where Big Rock Candy Mountain came from?
It may have. Oh no. I mean, there were other newspapers asking where's the sugar mountain? Tell us where the Lake of Whiskey is, you know? And was, as far as I can tell, this was the Dan Quayle misspelling potato of its day. Like, if you didn't like Thomas Jefferson or his policies, and a lot of people did not, or especially if you thought the Louisiana Purchase was like a big waste of money, which a lot of people did, you'd want to clown on Thomas Jefferson. So Thomas Jefferson gets just ratioed
dunked
over this. Okay. Just dunked on every day. The Boston Gazette wrote a poem about it, which I will read to you. Hero status of old, to eternize his name, set the temple of Diana all in a flame. But Jefferson lately of Bonaparte bought, to pickle his fame, a mountain of salt. And another paper said, like, commenting sort of in a meta way on this whole thing, was like, that this, quote, has called forth more queer remarks, puns, and epigrams than anything which has come to light under the present enlightened government, in scare quotes.
This is a meme.
It was a meme.
He's a meme. Right.
Thomas Jefferson and his salt mountain. So where did this come from? Well, a lot of explorers who were out in the Louisiana territory were sending information back to the U.S. government. They did say that there was like, they'd found a bunch of salt out there and they'd sent back samples of salt. And it seems like maybe somewhere in the translation, you know, like a whole lot of salt became like a whole mountain of salt, which then became a, in somebody's brain, a literal, you know, mountain of salt. It seemed like it was a game of telephone that unfortunately ended with the president who just believed the final thing. So when Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out to explore the Louisiana Purchase in 1804, he said, like, one of the reasons that he sent Lewis and Clark out there was that he wanted them to find the salt mountain because he really wanted to, like, his rep was on the line and he wanted them to try to, he's like, tell me anything you find about salt. I need to know. So Lewis and Clark, 2 years later, come back in 1806, and guess what? They did not find in the western United States a giant mountain. Well, I mean, Karen, if they had found it, you would know, because there'd be a big salt mountain, you know, in America. Which is, so Lewis and Clark found nothing, and they came back, and they're like, we didn't find a salt mountain. And then apparently it all started up all over again.
Oh, no.
Now the newspapers are... we do not learn that Lewis confirms the account given by the president a few years since of the huge mountain of salt. Therefore, we conclude that it has dissolved.
What?
So Jefferson leaves office 1809. Salt mountain or anything like it had not been discovered. Now, fortunately, in May of 1811, after Jefferson has been gone for a while, left office for a while, there was an explorer whose name was George Sibley, and he was a trader at Fort Osage, which is, it's right by modern-day Kansas City, Missouri. It's actually in the town of Sibley, Missouri, if you want to know how important George Sibley ends up being to that area. That's where the U.S. government had set up to trade with the Osage tribe of indigenous peoples, right? So he gets it in his head. He wants to go exploring, and he wants to try to find Jefferson's Salt Mountain. Now, the Osage tribe, what they end up showing him is now considered to be probably what everybody had been talking about. And it is now known as the Great Salt Plains of Oklahoma. So, and it's about a 5-hour drive today from historic Fort Osage to the Great Salt Plains of Oklahoma, if you want to know how long they walked to get there. So it's a whole bunch of, it's plains. And then underneath the plains is saline groundwater, salt groundwater. Probably just, there probably used to be a massive ancient sea there millions of years ago, but there's still salt groundwater. What happens is when the water level rises, the water level gets up to ground level, and then the sun bakes off the water.
And it leaves salt.
It leaves a big crust of salt all over the plains for miles and miles and miles. And indeed, this was all known to the tribes in that area. They used the salt. They fought war over the salt, you know? Yeah.
Right.
So what Sibley ends up writing is, after a long series of very hot weather, this section is nearly all covered with a solid rock of salt from 5 to 12 inches thick. And immediately around the springs, because there's salt springs that are kind of popping up too, a kind of hollow cones of salt are formed more than 2 feet above the general surface. At one of these, I hewed out with my tomahawk a block of salt 16 inches in thickness. The quality of the rock salt is unquestionably superior to any that I ever saw. It is beautifully white. And so, yes, they chunked off a lot of this salt. They sent back specimens. Yes, some of this salt did eventually get back to Jefferson. So he did eventually get to hold in his hands a chunk of salt from what turned out to be not a salt mountain, but salt plains. And you might have heard of like the Bonneville Salt Flats also, where they set land speed records. Like that's the same thing. It's just salt from rising up from the ground. So the interesting thing today, you can visit the Great Salt Plains State Park in Oklahoma. And what people typically do there is, there's usually like a layer of salt over the dirt. People don't really take home, I don't think they take home a lot of salt, but what's actually underground, a couple of feet underground, is crystals of a material called selenite. It's a form of gypsum. What you do is, this is interesting, it sounds like fun. You dig a hole, like 2 feet by 2 feet you know, wide and deep.
Whoa. It's big.
And in so doing and digging that hole, you're probably actually destroying a lot of the crystals because they're very fragile. But you can go do this for free because there's tons of these things. You dig a hole, you wait for it to fill up with water, and then you take the water and you splash it gently against the sides of the hole you just dug to sort of, it erodes the dirt away, but it leaves the crystals intact. And so you splash on the sides and you get the crystals and you pull these crystals out. And apparently it's the only place in the world you can find these. They have formed with an hourglass shaped inclusion of clay inside them. Huh. So you look at it and it's like a flat crystal with an hourglass of clay inside of it. Huh. And so that's the cool thing about going, I think, to the state park now, not so much the salt, which you can just get. But yeah, you just go buy salt now. You don't have to go. We don't have to go find it out in the wild. You know, people from hundreds of years ago, they're just like us. They say dumb things to Congress and they get clowned on. But it's not the 24-hour. It's not the 24-hour news cycle, though. It's like the 2-year news cycle where it just keeps going and going. And going.
It's not over it in a day.
You can't
or
get
two.
On top of it. No, you literally have to send out Lewis and Clark and be like, "Find the salt mountain. I'm getting killed out there."
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, he's like, "Listen, you guys build me a salt mountain if you have to."
You know? It's like an episode of Veep.
Selena. All right, Dina, your turn.
All right. I have a quiz for you all about salt. But basically, the answer to everything in this quiz is salt related. It's all salt related stuff. Barnyard buzzers ready, please. And all right. Let's get it started. Okay. The name of this lunch meat comes from the Latin word for salt. Chris.
Salami
yeah. is the lunch meat with salt in the name. How about this? In 2017, chef Nusret Gökçe became known as this when his flamboyant seasoning technique went viral. Think Karen.
Salt Bay.
Yeah, Salt Bay. You could eat at his restaurants. They're very expensive, apparently.
It's okay, just as long as you don't, I think, order like the gold-covered steak, you're going to be okay.
Yeah, sure.
This Roald Dahl character shares her name with a wart that appears on the bottom of the foot or toes.
Oh!
Colin.
Well, I mean, I can think of only a Veruca salt.
Veruca salt.
I did not know the connection to what is a plant or wart, some type of a what is
yeah.
it?
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's such good.
That's good.
Yeah. The only difference between a greyhound and this cocktail is the salted rim.
Oh.
Heard a horse, Colin?
It's a salty dog, right? Is that what it's called?
Salty dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, cute.
Yes. It's a cocktail with vodka, gin, and grapefruit juice. Mm-hmm. And it's a greyhound if you don't salt the rim. And if you do, it's a salty dog.
That's such a cute name.
It is. It makes me want one. But okay, anyway. how about this? Formed in 1985, this group featuring Cheryl James and Sandy Dinton is one of the best-selling rap acts of all time.
Oh,
Chris.
Salt and Peppa featuring Spinderella.
I saw them live like a couple, just 3 years ago.
Oh, still yeah. Rocketing. They're still out there. Yeah.
They're so good.
I tried to look into Salt and Peppa as a potential, you know, like either trivia thing or something like that. Actually, really, I was looking into Salt. Because
her name,
I feel like I could see somebody getting the nickname Peppa, and then like if you hang out with them enough, they're gonna start calling you Salt. But I don't know if that's how it happened, but that's my headcanon, you know.
I like your fan etymology. There's already
a Peppa.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then they're just like, well, you then I guess back. You're Salt.
Right.
Well, it's funny. Because I think Sandy is actually Peppa, and I feel like that matches Salt better. But it's a line from a song. They had a song, and then they were like, "Ooh, that's a good name." And then
they had a different name. Yeah, yeah.
And Spinderella.
And Spinderella.
And Spinderella. You know, she was 15 when she joined them.
What? Wow. I mean, you go back and you look and see so many celebrities start out. You're like, wow, they're so young, man, teenagers. Yeah.
I remember her, but I was like, oh, she's a grown up. But I was a small child. So yeah, 15 is like a grown up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
How about this? Until the 1990s, Mr. Salty was the mascot for what type of Nabisco product?
Nabisco. Oh, interesting.
Until the
90s. Okay. Oh,
they retired him in the 90s.
Oh, I mean, saltines? Saltines? No.
Oh, that was my guess.
Oh, really? It's not. Is it Ritz?
No.
No.
Oh, Mr. That's a good guess.
Mr. Salty.
He actually looks like the food that he is the mascot of.
Okay.
Oh, it's not the like peanut.
Nabisco Mr. Product. Peanut.
He's like a gingerbread man, but of this type of snack food.
Okay.
Oh.
Not it, okay. Potato.
Oh.
No.
Karen.
No. I thought it was what? Maybe a goldfish Nabisco? With the sunglasses.
Mr. Salty.
I feel like I know this. It's in
you
the punch bowl.
You guys are going to scream when you
Oh,
hear
it's
it.
In the punch bowl, Dana. Trisket. What is it?
Okay. Pretzels. Mr. Salty's pretzels. He's and now they brought him back and like there's a special handy snack with Mr. Salty pretzels,
right,
but
right.
they cut it.
Literally yeah. coated in.
he looks like a gingerbread man, but made out of pretzels.
Mm. Yeah, but with salt tumors. Yeah.
Yeah. how about this? This St. Patrick's Day staple gets its name from the salt curing process it goes through. And the name includes a reference to the salt. Colin?
Is that corned beef? Or
yes,
corned beef and cabbage?
Beef. Yeah. The corns refer to salt corns, like big old chunks of salt.
Oh,
or,
my God.
Yeah, so it's just like salted beef.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Okay, this New England-style house is known for its distinctive asymmetrical roof shape. I just learned about this in carpentry class.
Oh, yeah, it's...
We're taking carpentry class.
I'm taking it's carpentry
called,
now.
It's called like a salt box house, right? Or is that what it is?
Yeah, salt box. Okay. It's called a salt box. That's the style. It's like a kind of a short angle and then a long angle. And it's it's one of the first American colonial style of houses. All right, last question. This one I think is tricky because I didn't grow up with snow, but I think that people might know this.
Only Chris grew up with snow.
We'll see. This word is derived from hell, the ancient Greek word for salt, and is known as rock salt. It's another name for rock salt.
Oh.
Chris.
Halite.
Yes. Halite. I saw a fact about salt that I thought was really interesting. It was that more salt is used for salting like roads and highways than for people to
that's true. Oh, right? I bet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true. The volume of it.
Yep.
Anyway, good job, you guys. Some salt trivia.
Well, sort of related. This gives me a great chance to shoehorn in a salt fact that I might have otherwise had to sit on for this episode. I didn't want to mention that in case it was in your quiz. So this is. I will tell you, this is a trick question. What makes kosher salt kosher? You guys have all heard of kosher salt, right?
They cut its neck. No.
Yeah, right. I was
the way that they. So the way they drain the blood from the salt. Yeah.
growing up, I was always like, yeah, what makes kosher salt kosher?
Wait, isn't all salt kosher?
I thought
kosher?
It was the size.
It is.
So there's sort of a split answer to this. One, there is such a thing as salt, which is kosher, meaning like follows kosher dietary guidelines. But really, when they say that, all that means is it was prepared in a way that it didn't come into contact with non-kosher ingredients. It's been certified or vetted by a rabbi, you know, who specializes in that kind of thing. But there's nothing inherent to the salt that would otherwise be non-kosher. So that's one answer. The other answer, the main answer, and this is so simple, it was just like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. It's called kosher salt because it is salt used for koshering. Kosher, you know, it is the process of salting meat to make the meat kosher. The salt is what you use in producing a kosher product. You put the salt on, it draws the blood and other fluids, but that draws the blood out of the meat to make the meat kosher. And I was like, oh, that makes so
it's
much
the
sense.
Tool
and
it's for kosher.
That's right. It's a tool for koshering. Yeah. Kosher, but I do need to salt. Have the little asterisk there that there is such a thing as salt, which is itself then kosher. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Traffic jams. tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Calling all kids in the car. Brittany and Meredith here from the chart-topping Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Are you dreading another silent car ride with the fam? We've got the cure. 3 rounds of fresh trivia every single week. Movies, music, even science and Disney. We've got something for every trivia buff in the car. No more crickets chirping on those long journeys. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast is your secret weapon for connecting and laughing with kids of all ages, teens, toddlers, adults, it doesn't matter. Spark their curiosity and challenge their brains with every episode. New episodes drop weekly wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast and turn those car rides into epic adventures.
I'm at a grade school in Chicago. We're going to find out if these teachers listen to Good Job Brain. Emperor Qin Shi Huang ruled China until his death in 210 BC. How did he die?
Oh, it was definitely C. He was crushed.
It's mercury poisoning. D.
Ding, 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 ding.
No way.
Way.
Awesome.
Betty White or penicillin?
Which came first? No, penicillin.
That's crazy.
So you would learn all of these things if you listened to Good Job Brain.
I should. I will.
And we're back. You're listening to Good Job Brain, and this week we're all about salt. And speaking of salt, our normal salt, do you guys know what is the chemical name for salt?
Well, for table salt, you mean common table salt?
Common table salt.
Sodium chloride.
And the symbol?
NaCl.
NaCl. Here, I have a very quick word game quiz. I will give you a definition of a word, and you buzz in and tell me what word I'm looking for. Each of the answers have the letters NaCl in order. They're not a lot, and they're all very, very similar in terms of, I think, okay. Once you get one, you're like...
I thought of one.
Okay. All the other ones follow that pattern. So here
gotcha.
We go. Okay. NaCl okay. in the word, in order, next to each other, not spaced out, or, you know.
Dana's going to okay. dominate this
I'm
quiz.
I'm just like, yeah.
You're already going through. All right, here we go. This word means a temple or a place of worship. That was Chris.
Tabernacle.
Correct. Tabernacle. Mm, mm. Guess what? Every word in this quiz will rhyme with that.
Okay.
The knackle. Knackle. All right. This is the spire at the topmost of a building or something of great height.
Oh.
Colin.
The pinnacle.
Pinnacle. Pinnacle.
Pinnacle.
Pinnacle.
Mm-hmm. Pinnacle, the spire at the top, or now known as like the apex or the highest point. All right, next one, next word. This word means metal restraints for hands. Chris.
Manacle.
Manacle. Yes. Manacle. All right, we're off to some of the harder vocab words. Ooh. Now. Showing up at your... They don't take the SATs anymore, huh? Okay, anyways. Here we go.
Okay.
This word means the structure that houses the compass of a ship.
Ooh.
Oh.
Dana.
Is it the spinnacle? Is that a thing?
Spinnaker.
Spinnaker.
Mm.
That's my...
It is binnacle.
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 Huh.
Pinnacle and binnacle.
Interesting.
That's good.
Good Disney sidekick twin names. Binnacle and binnacle.
Binnacle.
This word means, this is actually the proper name of the room where the Last Supper was held, but also refers to like a group of writers or a clique of people.
Ooh.
Proper name of the room where the Last Supper was held. Maybe you art history people know it.
Writers.
Hold on a second.
Ends with knackle.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is called a cenacle. Cenacle.
Okay.
N-A-C-L-E with the big C. That is where we've seen supper. many paintings of the Last Supper. That's like the room where it's held. It's an upper room, usually like kind of roundish ceilings. Cenacle. All
right. It's funny that a group of writers is a cynical, but it's spelled wrong.
Cynical. Yeah. Cenacle.
Yeah.
All right, last word. Here we go. These are small crustaceans, usually attached to rocks or ship hulls. Dana!
This was the one I thought of first, was barnacle.
Save the best for last. It is barnacle. And let me tell you guys something, and I hope I do it justice because it blew my mind when I was researching this, and I hope I can convey that awe and that jaw-dropping feeling and share this fact with you guys. Why are barnacles called barnacles? I was like, oh, maybe I should look this up, you know, because I'm kind of like cross-referencing. I was like, oh, make sure my definitions for that quiz are accurate. So I was like, oh, let's look at the etymology of barnacles. I need to tell you the wild story. This is a wild story. So originally, in the 13th century, the barnacle is not the crustacean animal. The barnacle is a name of a goose, of like a water bird. Those are called barnacles. You know, now we call them the barnacle goose, just for clarification, but back then when you say barnacle, that means the water bird. This is from the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, and I quote, because the barnacle, the goose, breeds in the Arctic, no one at that time had ever witnessed the bird breeding. So as a result, it was thought to be spontaneously generated from trees along the shore or from rotting wood.
Well, listen, what else would it be? Yeah.
There's only one possible explanation here.
The wood gives birth to this goose.
The birds just emerge from fully the rotting wood. This is a simple conclusion that any child would come to.
When was this? When did this happen?
This is a 13th century. I mean, it was believed for quite a while. Adding to this, there is a type of barnacle that had very similar, like striking black and white coloring. Nowadays, we call that the goose barnacle. So now we have the barnacle goose, which is a goose. And we have the goose barnacle, which is a barnacle. So get this.
Okay.
People believed that the goose barnacle, the crustaceans, would grow into trees that would bear the fruits that become the barnacle goose bird.
Now, wait a second.
They have chickens. They have chickens
and
eggs.
Why would you overlook the obvious, I mean, equally absurd, but obvious, they just grow from the barnacles right into the birds. Like, that just seems to be to me.
No, Colin, that's ridiculous.
I guess
that's
I'm just being naive.
That's ridiculous. How dare you even suggest that?
Or that the eggs are just in the tree, because I'm sure they've never seen a barnacle fruit hatch a goose before. They've never seen this fruit, this giant fruit that has been.
This belief, this is known as the barnacle goose myth. People in history have documented and claimed that they've witnessed this barnacle goose tree. I'm going to share it. We're going to share it on Twitter. We're going to share it on Facebook. We're going to share it online. There are medieval drawings of trees that bear the fruit, and it's just like, it's not even an egg. It bypasses the egg. It's just the goose that forms into a fruit and it drops onto the ground. Multiple drawings in bird books, in science books. I cannot believe it. This was wildly believed during Lent. Oh, you know, man. The Catholics, they abstain from eating meat. They made it so that you can eat this barnacle goose because technically
because it's a fruit.
Free from a tree.
Because it's a fruit.
And so now what we know as barnacles, the crustaceans, is named after the goose that came from the barnacle goose tree.
Wow.
That's really fantastic.
Wow.
These pictures are so funny and so bad of like people's accounts Oh my God.
No one wanted to be the one they say they didn't believe in.
Nobody wanted to be the one that's like, I think those birds are just having sex, man.
I think they might just be birds, like the other birds that look like them but are a different color. I think they might just be birds as well.
If this is not true, what are these things on my ship and where did that tree come from? Answer me that, Abraham. Where did they come from?
Geese being fruit is like a real stumbling block. I would think that that would stop you. But this is not the same experience.
Other fruits don't turn into walking animals that honk.
Other fruits aren't full of guts and like this, like
bones.
Full on viscera.
To clarify, I think they thought it was more like a fish related animal. I mean, this similarly happened to the beaver. Right? Beavers were believed to be fish. And so
manatees were mermaids.
Yeah.
So you say coincidence. I say
goose tree.
Yeah.
All right. And we got one last segment. Colin, are you feeling salty?
I have a good segment for you all here. I hope that I had fun working on. And, you know, like a lot of Good Job Brain segments, it's got a little science, a little history. I remember really clearly as a kid, I was watching TV one night with my dad. We were watching some show or something. And, you know, it's 1980s, young Colin. I don't know what we were watching. Some car commercial comes on and it's a Trans Am or something. And it's this sort of car zooming across this sort of futuristic, deserty kind of environment. And, you know, the horizon looks like it goes on forever and the dramatic music is playing. And my dad's like, oh, it looks like that was filmed at the Salt Flats.
Salt Flats.
Yeah. My dad's like, oh, you know, the Salt Flats. I'm like, I don't know.
He just ruined your fantasy. Child.
Yeah. I'm as if I would know. I mean, this is pre-internet. This is pre.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, he goes on to tell me, my dad, about the Salt Flats, the Bonneville Salt Flats. And this, again, the 1980s, the first I'd ever heard of the Bonneville Salt Flats, and didn't hear about it a lot. When I did hear about it, it'd be from my dad, and kind of just sort of filed it away in the back of my mind as a young kid. You know, there was a car called the Pontiac Bonneville, and I remember we would see commercials for that, and my dad would be like, oh, I bet that car is named after the Bonneville Salt Flats. And,
wow.
This has some big Bonneville Salt Flats vibes to it.
Yeah.
Guy who's only ever heard of the Bonneville Salt Flats.
So you all know that I love to go hiking and camping and visiting Utah. I was just there a couple weeks ago. I think I talked about it on previous episode. I cannot shut up about it. I love Utah. Utah is great. Among many, many other things, Utah is home to the Bonneville
That's
Salt
where
Flats.
It is.
Yes, it is.
I've been sitting here guessing. I was like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, where is it?
Yeah.
Utah, home to the Great Salt Lake. And if you head west from the Great Salt Lake out toward the border, there are a number of salt flats out in that part of Utah. And the Bonneville Salt Flats is the biggest of them. What is a salt flat? Chris sort of touched on it earlier. A salt flat, also called a salt pan. One way of thinking of it is just it's the remnants of a dried up lake. Sometimes they refill with water, like the ones that our man Tommy Jeffs was looking for, perhaps. oftentimes they are just totally dry. They are the remnants of lakes, inland seas that were there many, many, many thousands up to millions of years ago that have dried up and left behind the minerals, oftentimes salt. It is 12 miles long, 5 miles wide. The salt crust. Okay, now remember, this was, you know, water at one time and minerals, and it's evaporated. It's left behind a lot of salt, a lot of salt. It's 5 feet thick in parts as you approach the middle.
No way.
Yeah. There's a lot of salt there. Yeah.
A petite person.
If you could drown in the salt there at the middle, you could drown in the salt. It's pretty solid, though. You won't drown in it. My dad was correct. I'm sure that car commercial was filmed out there. They film a lot of car commercials out on the Bonneville Salt Flats.
Why?
Not just because it looks so cool, because it's just, you know, this sheen of white, you know, seemingly out forever, miles in the directions. But it is extremely, extremely, extremely flat. and regular. And it just, it's so flat and so big, you can see the curvature of the Earth even. You can't, like, you can't see over the middle of it to the far side. It is very, 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 very flat. One of the flattest parts of our fine country. So almost as far back as there were cars, people realized this was a pretty good spot to go out and race cars and drive around because there's nothing out there. You're not going to run into anything. You're not going to drive off the edge of a cliff. You're not going to run into trees. It sounds like people were racing and trying to set, you know, speed records there as far back as like 1912, even, you know, the early teens. But racing and auto sports and the Bonneville Salt Flats, they really go hand in hand today.
Wow.
If you didn't know that, now you know.
No.
And I have learned that almost all of this history, it goes back to the results of almost exclusively one person, really kind of the father of salt racing, a man named Ab Jenkins, David Abbott. Ab Jenkins. It's such a great yeah. name. Ab Jenkins. Okay. Yeah. Ab Jenkins was a native Utahn. He grew up out there. He liked to race. He raced motorcycles. He raced cars. He raced kind of whatever he could get his body into. By the 1930s, okay, he had become a big, if not the leading figure in the racing and kind of car head scene out in the Salt Flats area in Utah in particular. And he started organizing races out there. He started inviting other drivers to come out and really kind of promoted it as this is the place to come do it. He, Ab Jenkins really kind of saw, he had a vision there that Bonneville Salt Flats could sort of become the premier place. And it did become a great place for racing. It also specifically became the place to go set land speed records. So from the 30s way into the 70s, the 90s even, this was the place. All right. So over the 1930s, Ab Jenkins himself and a lot of other racers on the scene kind of jockeyed back and forth setting speed records, and not, you know, they would have like endurance records of how fast can you average over 24 hours? How fast can you go? What's the fastest mile, you know? And I mean, any record category you can think of, they would find a new way to do it. And at one time in the 1930s, he was driving a racer that was dubbed the Mormon Meteor. This car, it was named by, there was a write-in campaign by the local Salt Lake City newspaper, and that was the winning name for this car. I hesitate to say car, right? I should use air quotes. It was essentially a race car body that had an aircraft engine dropped into it, okay?
Oh, my power. Gosh.
World War II came along. There were, as you probably know, a lot of resource-intensive activities that the government curtailed during World War II. And as you might imagine, burning huge amounts of gasoline and chewing up rubber tires out on the salt flats was considered maybe a little excessive. So they basically put a halt to all these kind of, understandably, maybe frivolous pursuits like auto racing and speed records out in the desert. So there was no racing going on for World War II. And Ab Jenkins figured, well, can't race, can't put on races, I might as well run for mayor. So he ran for mayor of Salt Lake City and won handily. It sounds like just easily became mayor of Salt Lake City. Yeah, he was mayor from 1940 to 1944, apparently without really spending much time or money on it at all. Just like this is how well known he was at the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
After the war was over, he went back to racing. Ab Jenkins eventually retired. He got into a crash apparently at 200 miles an hour and was in his 60s and kind of figured, you know what, maybe this is the time to walk away from racing. Yeah, he was okay in that crash.
Wow, he was okay going that fast in a car that was made at that time.
Yeah,
it's really impressive. Yeah. They're real casual with seatbelts, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. 1951. I guess his car skidded and on a puddle of water.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to say I had to look it up. The modern day seatbelt was patented in only 1955. 4 years after his 1951 crash.
I mean, I don't know how much a seatbelt would have done for him. A 1951 seatbelt at 200 miles an hour, right? Yeah. But he did, he died from a heart attack. So he was driving the pace car at a race in Wisconsin. And after the race, came back and died of a heart attack. And it was sad, but he died shortly after doing what he loved, driving a car at a race. And he was so beloved in the world of racing and that scene that the next year, when General Motors introduced the Pontiac Bonneville, it was in part in tribute to Ab Jenkins and him putting Bonneville on the map. Yeah, and making it a site for racing, speeding, all kinds of stuff.
So your dad was right.
My dad was more right than he knew, even. Yeah. I gotta make it out to this place eventually. So, as cool as the Bonneville Salt Flats are, it is not the only famous salt flat in the world, nor is it the biggest. We gotta give that up to Bolivia. Bolivia is home to the Salar de Uyuni, the largest salt flat in the world, 100 times larger than the Bonneville salt flat.
Wow.
It is surface area of 6,500 square miles. Chris, for reference, your home state of Connecticut has a total area of around 5,500 square miles, according to the internet. So this salt flat is bigger than Connecticut. It is a little bit bigger than the total area of Hawaii.
This is a big old salt flat.
Yeah. It is so big, so wide, so flat, and at such a high elevation. All right, it's at about 12,000 feet. It has such clear skies that the Earth monitoring and observation satellites use it as a calibration check. It is so easy to target for them. They know the elevation that when they fly by, they just do boop, just do a check like, okay, here's our calibration on it.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
After a rain here in this part of Bolivia, if you get a nice layer of calm water on the Salar de Uyuni, it is effectively the world's largest mirror.
Sure.
And if you look up some photos of it, you know, so from flat. Google Earth or wherever, you can look and see, you know, clouds and things back in it. I mean, it's so flat, so big, so reflective, so still. And of course, Chris talked about taking salt chunks out. Yeah, they have like salt hotels out here, which are built out of, you know, bricks made of chunks taken from the salt here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I cannot go without mentioning something this dramatic, this epic, it sounds cinematic. It is cinematic. It has been featured in several movies, most recently / famously. This served as the location for the planet Crait in Star Wars, The Last Jedi, the big final battle scene where, you know, one of the actors even kind of helpfully reaches down and like tastes it. It tastes like salt. And like, yes, it is. It is, in fact, salt. Okay. Yeah. That was in Bolivia, yeah. And minus, you know, I mean, Adam Driver and the little crystal foxes, it really looks like that. It really looks like that, yeah.
Yep.
So I had really, really, really no idea that sort of this offhand comment from my dad would spur all this knowledge of salt flats many years later. So thank you, Dad.
Cool.
And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about salt, barnacles, salt flats, Tommy Jeffs, and you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on all podcast apps, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, I Know What Scares You, and Investing for Beginners. And we'll see you guys next week. Salt Bay.
Bye.
Salt Bay.
Salt Bay.
Salt Bay.
Salt Bay.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right.
The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.